Welcome to the Teep Dive. I'm incredibly thrilled you're joining us today because we are looking at a true, undeniable legend.
Oh, absolutely undeniable.
Right. We are talking about a woman who is widely considered the undisputed first lady of the musical comedy stage. Today's deep dive is entirely focused on the one and only Ethel Merman.
A giant of the American theater.
She really was. And the source material we are drawing from today is a highly comprehensive Wikipedia article that details her entire life, her monumental career highs, and honestly, a personal life that was surprisingly turbulent.
Very turbulent, yeah. There's a lot of friction there.
So our mission for you today is to unpack a pretty incredible transformation. We want to figure out how a stenographer from Queens, someone with absolutely zero formal vocal training, managed to become a Broadway powerhouse who completely redefined American theater.
It's a fascinating journey.
It really is. We're also going to explore the fascinating and frankly sometimes heartbreaking friction between her larger-than-life, brassy stage persona and what was actually happening behind closed doors.
Okay, let's unpack this because you really can't understand modern Broadway without understanding her.
You really can't. And to fully appreciate what she accomplished, we need to set the stage and put you, the listener, right in the audience of a theater in the 1930s.
Which was a very different experience back then.
Completely different. What made her so utterly unique was that she was performing in an era before stage microphones were standard equipment.
Wow, right. No microphones at all.
None. Think about the physical mechanics that requires from a human body. She had to project her voice to the very back row of a massive, crowded, often really noisy theater.
Just using her own lung power?
Using nothing but her own lungs, her diaphragm, and her vocal cords. Her sheer vocal power, combined with this astonishingly precise enunciation, wasn't just an impressive party trick. It was a literal game changer for the entire medium of musical theater. Because composers could actually write differently for her, right?
Exactly. Composers suddenly realized they could write entirely differently. They could write bigger, much more complex orchestrations because they knew they had a voice like hers to cut through the brass section and carry the melody.
Now, with a voice that powerful and transformative, you would almost assume she was, you know, groomed for the stage from day one, like a child prodigy pushed by theatrical parents. Did she come from a show business family?
Not even remotely. She was born Ethel Agnes Zimmerman in Astoria, Queens. The year was 1908, though true to showbiz form, she later firmly insisted to anyone who asked that she was born in 1912.
Naturally. Got to shave off a few years.
Of course. She was an only child to very pragmatic, church-going parents. Her father was an accountant, and her mother was a school teacher.
So a very grounded, practical household.
Very much so. Now, her family did take the subway into Manhattan on Friday nights to see vaudeville shows at the Palace Theater. Vaudeville was the dominant entertainment of the era.
Those fast-paced, loud variety shows.
Yeah. Exactly. Featuring singers, comedians, acrobats. She absolutely absorbed that energy, but her parents remained incredibly grounded. They actually insisted she learn secretarial skills as a fallback plan.
Just in case the whole singing pipe dream didn't pan out.
Right.
I imagine she wasn't thrilled about that, but from what the source material says, she actually put that fallback plan to use for a while.
She did. She took a commercial course in high school, learned shorthand, and became a highly capable, very fast stenographer. After graduating in 1924, she started out earning $23 a week doing office work.
Which was decent money back then.
It was. Eventually, she crossed paths with a man named Vic Kleisrath, who offered her a $5 raise to come work at his company. That led to her becoming the personal secretary to the company's president, Kayla Bragg.
And this is where the story gets kind of amazing.
It's a brilliant example of how a mundane day job can accidentally facilitate a dream. Kayla Bragg was a wealthy, eccentric guy who frequently took lengthy, unannounced absences from the office to go race automobiles.
Wait, so her boss was just abandoning the office to go drive race cars?
Precisely. And while he was off at the racetrack, Ethel was using the quiet, empty office to sleep.
Because she was working nights.
Yes. She was secretly moonlighting, taking late-night singing gigs at private parties and speakeasies. She was burning the candle at both ends, and having an absentee boss gave her the literal physical rest she needed to keep her vocal cords intact while she built her stage chops.
That is incredible luck. But obviously she didn't stay a secretly moonlighting secretary forever. How did she make the jump from Ethel Zimmerman, the sleeping stenographer, to Ethel Merman, the marquee name?
The name change was actually a purely practical business decision. As she started getting bigger club gigs, She realized that Ethel Zimmerman was simply too long to fit in the physical space of a theater marquee.
It takes up a lot of light bulbs.
Way too many. She brainstormed combining her first name with her grandmother's maiden name, Hunter. But her father strongly disapproved of her dropping the family name entirely.
So what did she do?
To appease him and solve her marquee problem, she just dropped the Zim and the N's from Zimmerman. Ethel Merman was born.
It's such a pragmatic solution. But right as she is gaining all this traction in the nightclub scene and getting noticed by influential columnists, she hits a massive roadblock. The source details a medical situation that sounds like a singer's absolute worst nightmare.
Oh, the tonsillectomy.
Yeah, she needed a tonsillectomy.
For any singer, but especially an untrained one who relies entirely on raw, unpolished power, throat surgery is terrifying. The fear is that removing the tonsils will permanently alter the shape of the vocal tract and ruin the voice.
Yet the exact opposite happens. She wakes up, recovers, and discovers that her voice is actually significantly more powerful than it was before the surgery. It's an absolute medical anomaly.
It was almost superhuman. And that newly supercharged voice set her up for her massive breakthrough in 1930. She auditioned for George and Ira Gershwin's new musical, Girl Crazy.
Which was a huge deal.
Massive. The theater producer, Vinton Friedley, had seen her in a club and brought her in. The Gershwins asked her to sing a little song they had written called I Got Rhythm.
Just a little song.
Right, just a minor classic. They cast her on the spot. But the most crucial detail of this encounter is what George Gershwin told her afterward. After hearing the raw, undeniable force of her performance, he famously advised her never, ever to take a single vocal lesson.
A composer of George Gershwin's caliber telling a young singer not to train. Was he afraid she'd lose the volume? Or was about something else?
He recognized that her unpolished, rougher-on-the-edges delivery was exactly what made her captivating. If a vocal coach tried to smooth her out, to teach her classical breath control or standard phrasing, they would erase her unique signature. I'd ask you, listening to this, to think about your own natural talents or quirks.
That's a great point.
Sometimes the absolute best advice you can get is knowing when not to mess with what naturally works. The world constantly tells us to formalize our skills, but Merman's untrained power was her differentiator. The New Yorker magazine later described her as being imitative of no one.
Imitative of no one. She took that unique instrument and paired it with a work ethic that sounds almost punishing. Let's look at her absolute dominance on Broadway. Just to give you a sense of her physical stamina, she starred in Irving Berlin's Annie Get Your Gun, which opened in 1946.
A legendary run.
That show ran for 11,147 performances. During that entire grueling, nearly three-year run, she took only two vacations and missed exactly two shows due to illness.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that level of endurance is staggering. Doing eight shows a week, belting over a full live orchestra without a microphone, requires the lung capacity and muscular stamina of an elite athlete. She became the defining voice of the American musical, acting as the muse for Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, and all the greats.
But while she was the undisputed queen of New York, her relationship with Hollywood and the film industry was a completely different story. Her immense stage success repeatedly failed to translate to the silver screen. Why do you think that was?
It's a fascinating contrast. Hollywood in the 1930s was a totally different ecosystem than Broadway.
You look at the 1936 film adaptation of Cole Porter's Anything Goes as an example. She had starred in the stage version on Broadway to massive Universal acclaim, but when it goes to film, the Hollywood studio machine completely alters the dynamic.
They really did. First, the studio shifted the entire focus to her co-star, Bing Crosby, pushing Merman into a supporting role.
Taking the spotlight right off her.
Exactly. And more importantly, Hollywood was operating under the Motion Picture Production Code, which was a very strict set of industry censorship laws. Cole Porter's brilliantly ribald, slightly naughty, sophisticated New York lyrics were heavily censored or cut entirely to appease the morality police.
They even cut one of her biggest numbers and forced her to perform a bizarre brand new song called Shanghai to Ho.
Which was just a disaster.
Yeah. Reading the description of that scene feels like a fever dream. They made her sing this new song wearing a massive headdress made out of peacock feathers, completely surrounded by dancers dressed as Chinese slave girls.
It was visually absurd.
Culturally tone deaf, even for the time, and it completely stripped away the brassy, modern, sophisticated charm that made her famous in the first place.
Merman realized very early on that her unpolished, loud, authentic persona was her actual product. Hollywood's constant attempts to soften her censor her, or put her in absurd costumes was essentially stripping away her brand authenticity.
They didn't know what to do with her.
They really didn't. One critic at the time noted that she did as well as possible, but she simply couldn't register on a film screen as magnificently as she did commanding a live stage. She never quite trusted the Hollywood studio process after that experience.
And that lack of trust was deeply validated decades later. The ultimate professional disappointment for her came with the film adaptation of Gypsy in 1959.
Oh, that was a brutal blow.
She originated the iconic role of Rose on Broadway. It's arguably the greatest, most demanding role in American musical theater history. She was earning an estimated $130,000 a year for the stage run,
which was astronomical wealth in 1959.
Plus 10% of the box office receipts. She owned that character inside and out.
She did. And the film's director, Mervyn LeRoy, kept coming to see the Broadway production, repeatedly assuring Merman that she was locked in to star in the film adaptation. But brutal studio politics intervened.
The lead film role was suddenly given to Rosalind Russell.
Out of nowhere.
And the background on why that happened is wild. Russell's husband was a powerful producer who held the rights to another intellectual property the studio desperately wanted.
So he leveraged it.
He essentially blackmailed the studio, telling them they could only have his property if his wife, Rosalind Russell, was given the lead in Gypsy. Merman was absolutely devastated. She openly called it the greatest professional disappointment of her entire life.
And she didn't stay quiet about it.
No, she even gave Rosalind Russell's husband a very specific, biting nickname in the press.
Mm.
She called him the Lizard of Roz.
Classic mermaid.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because despite that massive heartbreak and her friction with studio executives, she still managed to leave a highly memorable mark on screen.
She definitely did.
She won a Golden Globe for the film version of Call Me Madam. She starred in the massive, chaotic 1963 ensemble comedy. It's a mad, 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 mad world, playing Milton Berle's overbearing, loudmouthed mother-in-law. And she introduced herself to a completely new generation in the 1980 spoof comedy Airplane.
Her cameo in Airplane is legendary.
It's so good.
She plays Lieutenant Hurwitz, a shell-shocked soldier in a military hospital who is convinced he's Ethel Merman.
Mm.
The scene is just her leaping out of a hospital bed, belting in Everything's Coming Up Roses while orderlies desperately try to sedate her.
It showed a wonderful, totally unpretentious willingness to completely self-parody. But as we transition into her personal life, you start to see that this tough, brassy, unapologetic persona we've been talking about wasn't just a character she played. It was the armor she wore to navigate the world. And her personal life required a lot of armor because it was incredibly turbulent. She was married 4 times, and the details are quite heavy.
They are. None of her marriages brought her the kind of lasting peace or stability she seemed to be searching for. Let's look at the timeline. Her first marriage was to a theatrical agent named William Smith. That union lasted exactly 2 months before they separated.
Just 2 months. Then she married Robert Levitt, a newspaper executive. This was her longest relationship. They were married for over a decade and had 2 children together, Bethel and Robert Jr.
But that marriage ultimately ended in divorce, heavily driven by Levitt's excessive drinking and erratic behavior.
Her 3rd marriage was to Robert Six, a prominent airline executive. This relationship was particularly dark.
Very dark. According to accounts later shared by Merman's son, Six was physically and emotionally abusive to Merman, to her children, and even to her elderly parents.
That's awful.
He also deeply resented it when she tried to step back from the spotlight to embrace a quieter life as a housewife. He basically forced her to take the lead in a Broadway show called Happy Hunting, simply so he could use her high-profile public appearances to generate free publicity for his airline.
And she hated that show.
She absolutely despised doing it.
Which brings us to marriage number 4. The infamous, incredibly brief union with the actor Ernest Borgnine. They were married for exactly 32 days in 1964. The surviving anecdote from this marriage tells you everything you need to know about Ethel Merman's razor-sharp wit.
Oh, this story's incredible.
Borgnine allegedly came home and asked her how an audition went. She replied that the producers loved her 35-year-old body, her 35-year-old voice, and her 35-year-old face.
And Borgnine cruelly replied by asking what they thought of her aging 65-year-old anatomy.
And Merman, without missing a single beat, snapped back, "You weren't mentioned once."
A completely devastating comeback.
So quick.
And her public revenge on Borgnine was permanent. When she published her autobiography in 1978, she included a chapter titled, "My Marriage to Ernest Borgnine." The chapter consisted of exactly one blank page.
Just brilliant. She actually maintained a surprisingly great sense of humor about her romantic failures. She gave a radio interview once where she casually said, "We all make mistakes. That's why they put rubbers on pencils, and that's what I did. I made a few Lulus."
That's a fantastic line. But that brash, unapologetic, often profane nature was fundamentally a survival mechanism. She was navigating a grueling, fiercely competitive, male-dominated industry.
And she had to be tough.
She desperately needed that tough exterior because she endured unimaginable personal grief offstage. Her daughter, Ethel, died of an accidental drug overdose in 1967. Years later, her son's estranged wife was shot and killed in an unsolved murder in a Los Angeles parking garage.
The sheer amount of psychological weight she carried while still going out there every night and belting out joyful show tunes is staggering.
It really is.
And she certainly never lost her edge, even in polite company. The swear jar story with Loretta Young perfectly illustrates this. Young was a devout Catholic and ran a very strict, highly sanitized set on her television show. Merman was rehearsing a guest appearance and casually dropped the H word.
Which was a big deal to Loretta Young.
Oh, yeah. Loretta Young marches right up to her, shaking an empty coffee can, and says, "Miss Merman, you said the H word. That'll be 25 cents.
And Merman's response.
Merman just stares at her and says, "Tell me, Loretta, how much will it cost me to tell you to go expletive yourself?"
She absolutely refused to be managed, policed, or diminished by anyone. And it's also interesting to look at the social and political circles she ran in when she wasn't on stage.
Yeah.
Factually, she was a lifelong staunch Republican, moving in very elite political spheres.
Yes. And as a quick note to you listening, we're just impartially reporting the historical facts from the source material here, not endorsing any political stance. But she was a frequent and highly welcome guest at the White House under Dwight D. Eisenhower.
She openly referred to him as her war hero and the president she admired most in her lifetime.
She also performed Everything's Coming Up Roses at Ronald Reagan's first presidential inauguration in 1981. It's a fascinating contrast, this brash, foul-mouthed, independent Broadway star being a darling of the conservative political establishment of the era.
It paints a very complex, multidimensional picture of her values and her offstage life. It shows a woman who is entirely comfortable navigating the highest echelons of power on her own terms.
So let's move into the final act of her career and her life, because even as she entered her later years, she never truly lost her grip on Broadway. In 1970, she finally joined the cast of the smash hit Hello, Dolly.
And this is a beautiful, full-circle moment in theater history. The original producer, David Merrick, had actually encouraged the composer, Jerry Herman, to write the entire score of Hello, Dolly, specifically tailored to Ethel Merman's unique vocal range.
So she was the original inspiration.
She was the muse for the entire show. But when they initially offered her the role, she toned it down, citing exhaustion.
But she finally steps into the role years later. She is the seventh actress to play Dolly Levi on Broadway, and the reaction was explosive.
Completely explosive.
On her opening night, her performance was continually brought to a halt by prolonged, deafening standing ovations from the audience. The critics raved. Walter Kerr wrote in the New York Times that her voice was exactly as trumpet clean and penny whistle piercing as it ever was. She ended up winning a Drama Desk Award for the performance.
It was a triumphant storybook final bow on the Broadway stage.
It really was.
What's fascinating here is the sharp contrast between that public triumph and her private decline. The physical toll of age eventually caught up with her in a remarkably cruel way. In 1983, she was preparing to travel to Los Angeles to appear on the Academy Awards telecast, and she suddenly collapsed in her New York apartment.
Doctors initially thought she had suffered a stroke, right?
They did, but exploratory surgery revealed a stage 4 glioblastoma, which is terminal brain cancer.
The really heartbreaking part of this diagnosis was how the tumor affected her physically. It caused severe aphasia, meaning she rapidly lost her ability to understand or express speech.
For a woman whose entire legacy, whose entire identity and fortune was built on precise, powerful enunciation and absolute vocal control, it is a devastatingly cruel twist of fate.
And her family handled the decline with incredible, fierce loyalty. Her son, Robert Jr., took charge of her care and made the deliberate decision to keep the true nature of her terminal illness completely hidden from the public and the press.
He later explained that his mother drew incredibly strict, impenetrable lines between her public life and her private reality. She loved the fans and she lived for the applause, but she didn't want the public in her personal business.
She wanted to maintain that strong, invulnerable barrier to the very end.
And she did. She passed away quietly at her home in Manhattan in February 1984, 10 months after her diagnosis. She was 76 years old.
The theater community's response was immediate and profound. On the evening she died, all 36 theaters on Broadway dimmed their marquee lights at 9 p.m. in her honor. She left behind a $1.5 million estate for her son and grandchildren.
And a few months later, the Academy Awards closed their global broadcast with a massive tribute performance of her signature Irving Berlin song, There's No Business Like Show Business.
So what does this all mean? When we look back at the incredible, sweeping life of Ethel Merman, we see a story of pure, unfiltered authenticity. She didn't have the classical training. She completely refused to fit into the quiet, demure Hollywood mold.
She was loud. She was fiercely tough.
She made mistakes in her personal life, and she owned every single bit of it. Her refusal to compromise her raw, natural talent allowed her to define an entire era of the American musical. She proved that sometimes the most powerful thing you can do is just stand center stage, take a deep breath, and let your unpolished, natural voice be heard.
It is an undeniably inspiring legacy, and it leaves me with a thought I'd like to put out there for you to ponder long after we finish today. Merman's legendary status was built on her ability to project to the back of the theater without a microphone. In today's highly amplified, auto-tuned, digitally perfected entertainment landscape, has technology actually robbed us of the chance to experience raw, overwhelming human power like Ethel Merman's? Does technological perfection make our art less human?
That is a phenomenal question to chew on. Something to think about the next time you listen to a perfectly produced modern track. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the life of the incomparable Ethel Merman. We love taking these journeys with you, exploring the facts, the stories, and the fascinating lives that shaped our world. Until next time, keep listening, keep questioning, and take care.